It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Kate Archer-Kent. 1 billion children worldwide are at extremely high risk from the effects of climate change. That's the latest findings from UNICEF, the United Nations agency that provides humanitarian aid to children. It's an issue that has motivated young people around the world to take action. Swedish teenager Greta Thunberg became one of the most recognizable voices after she led tens of thousands of students on strike to call attention to the need for stronger international climate agreements.
It has now almost been 3 years since the school strike started. And since then, millions of more children have joined the fight, fighting for a safe future and a safe present. Children are the ones who will be most impacted by this crisis and the ones who will suffer the most from its consequences.
Thunberg once famously told a room full of the world's most powerful politicians, quote, "You all come to us young people for hope. How dare you? You've stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words." Do you worry about the world that we're leaving our children and grandchildren? How do you think they'll be able to cope with the effects of climate change in the decades to come? We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Joining us this morning to discuss the latest findings from UNICEF is Beth McCausland. She's the managing director of the Midwest region for UNICEF USA. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Molly.
Good morning. Good morning to you. Well, I want to talk about your new report looking at the risks facing children around the world. Why catalog these risks to children specifically?
Yes. Well, as you certainly had opened or shared in your opening, the risks that are impacting children because of climate change, these kids are the ones who bear no responsibility largely for the climate crisis around the planet, but absolutely are suffering the most both today, and this is the world they'll inherit in the future. And so for us, UNICEF, as a global organization charged with a mandate for all things children and child rights, really has an expertise around data as well, and using that data to help us drive solutions and drive change for children. And so this was an opportunity for us to be able to synthesize the risks that we're seeing around the planet in parallel with different indicators that we're seeing on child well-being. And so in that regard, data and knowledge is truly power, and it will allow governments and businesses and communities and young people to tackle the problem in ways that are really targeting the hardest to hit.
Yeah, well, let's talk about some of the effects. I want to talk about hurricanes. You know, we've got Hurricane Ida on our minds with more than a million people without power in Louisiana and Mississippi over the weekend. I mean, we know that hurricanes can be some of the most costly and devastating natural disasters, and they're getting worse. What do we know about how children and families there are coping?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. And I think that's it. We see the headlines that say 1 million without power. It's tough to come back, the flooding and the destruction. But I think if you go the next step further and think about it through the lens of a child, those are kids who are getting ready to go back to school or maybe back in school, and now their education has been paused. Those were kids who maybe were set for their wellness checks or other important doctor's appointments. Those are now being put on pause. Children's lives are being put on pause through these sorts of disruptions, both as we're seeing right here on our own shores, but also in parallel around the planet. And of course, we are feeling and seeing that these are only getting stronger and more destructive and frequent. And so I think for me, I have two young children, you know, and I think about like what it's like to go and run and grab all of the flashlights and the other things to try and like make our family safe in emergency or otherwise. But like, if you go the next layer further to think about what this means for kids, and certainly down in New Orleans and Louisiana and Mississippi, like the trauma of the experience for these children as well is something that stays with them for a long time.
I feel that. I lived through Hurricane Andrew in Florida, and that was a huge event, even by those standards back in the 90s.
Absolutely. No, it's true. And I think, you know, UNICEF is actually, we were an organization born out of emergency response 75 years ago after World War II. And truly emergency response means in humanitarian response within that remain a really key part of the work that we do. We respond for all things children in 300 emergencies around the planet. And so at present, we are assessing the situation here domestically down in Louisiana and Mississippi with our partners in the community, but we have a history also of responding here domestically on being able to support and provide some of the technical assistance that we can draw from our experience around the world and things like restarting education for kids, helping kids feel kind of psychologically safe as they're coming back into the classroom after a really disruptive event like this, different things in terms of child protection and helping to connect kids who have maybe been separated from their families. So we have experience doing that along the South, really, in terms of where some of these, you're talking about Andrew, Hurricane Harvey of a couple of years ago.
Katrina.
This Katrina. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Actually, we have in our Midwest office a box of school supplies, a mobile school, if you will. It's a large, gosh, if you could think about it, an extra large suitcase made out of metal filled with school supplies. That was one of the interventions that we had shared for Hurricane Katrina 16 years ago. How can kids just continue learning when they don't have access to their classrooms or their classrooms have been destroyed? And so that's something that we can take a look at both here, but it's sort of a part of our getting back to learning portfolio after an emergency like this around the planet.
So you would deliver these, you would take these around to crisis spots, to disasters to help children learn.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, we can follow that thread there because I think it's one of the most interesting things that UNICEF brings to the table for our response for kids is just this massive supply network. Actually, we have a global supply warehouse in Copenhagen and then associated spaces throughout the world that we can move supplies within 24 hours to the hardest to reach places. And so we also saw and used that surge capacity, that supply capacity, just in the last couple of weeks in response to the earthquake and then the following tropical storm down in Haiti as well. And so that's a big piece of the way that UNICEF can respond for children too, is we have a footprint in 190 countries around the world. And so also as a part of our planning process in each one of those countries, it's thinking about what is the disaster or the climate event or other types of emergencies that might hit in this place, and how do we plan accordingly? Having pre-positioned supplies or plans in place and networks of partners, and understanding how to launch a community assessment after something like that happens is a part of our portfolio. In Haiti, for example, we were able to move out medical supplies to one of the hospitals down in the south there. Within 24 hours of that earthquake hitting, you know, as moms are standing just outside of the hospital with their children needing urgent care, the convoy can come rolling up with the supplies that they need.
So we've talked about hurricanes, earthquakes.
Yeah.
What are some of the other risks that you found in this in this research surveying the risks to children worldwide?
Yeah. No. That's great question. To dial it back just even to the macro of what this report is, it really was a first of its kind comprehensive analysis of climate risk from a child's perspective. So what we did is take two sort of overlays. One are those risks that we're talking about, those the tropical storms and heating, our heating planet and the overwarming in places. Flooding is a really significant issue that affects so many children around the planet, both coastal flooding and river flooding. Just access to clean air, something we can take so for granted as we just like look out and can see the big blue sky here in the Midwest. And then on the other side of this index, were just different indicators as it relates to to child well-being. So health and nutrition and ability to breathe that clean air. If you put those two pieces together and overlay that data, that helps us to see where children are truly the most vulnerable. And so the report lists it out in that way. And the tough part about this is that we really see, gosh, 95% of the world's children are impacted by at least one of these things. But unfortunately, there are far too many kids who are impacted by a number of these different risk factors. That gets really complicated.
We're speaking with Beth McCausland, Managing Director for the Midwest Region for UNICEF USA. This is The Morning Show. I'm Molly Stentz. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. We're talking about the latest findings from UNICEF about how children are particularly vulnerable to our changing climate. We have with us Beth McCausland, Managing Director of the Midwest Region for UNICEF USA. Do you believe that future generations will be able to manage climate change? Or is this an existential threat to humanity? Join us. We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Beth, we've been talking about disasters in the southern U.S. and Haiti. And I wonder who, when you look globally at the risks posed by climate change to children, who's most impacted?
No, it's an excellent question. I mean, I think as we look at, if you follow the report and follow into the data, what we're also seeing, for example, the Central African Republic is the country most at risk, or where its children are the most at risk based on these different indexes. And what's unfortunate about that is that you also then see in many of these countries that fall within that top 10, that top 20, places that where children are also caught in a significant amount of conflict. And so the cycle that we're seeing is that in places of conflict and insecurity, there's also less resilience to be able to combat some of these natural or even man-made climate challenges. And then it keeps flipping. That then feeds the insecurity as well. But I think I can tell you too, there's beyond just the weather crises, there's other types of effects on children. One with an interesting a solution team that's based actually in Wisconsin. And so as I was reading through the report and thinking about, you know, life here with my own two young kids, I was shocked by the numbers around the lead poisoning. And so nearly one third of the world's children are impacted by lead exposure. And so coming back to that, we know that that's particularly bad for babies. You were asking, you know, who's really most vulnerable? One of the things that we see throughout the report and throughout the world is that those under five, those, again, least responsible for what the world is doing in this space, are the most vulnerable to this. Children under five are, their brains are still developing, they're physically less resilient to these sorts of shocks. But with lead, that's truly the case. As we know, brains are still developing under five, and particularly with babies. And so lead exposure in the early years can be really devastating for kids.
And how do you draw that connection from lead poisoning to climate change?
Well, it's the climate shocks of it, the environmental shocks of it. I guess you could pan it up in that way. So beyond just the weather type climate, it is the climate in which these children are living. And so actually UNICEF has partnered up with Wisconsin-based company Clarios Foundation and another partner of ours called Pure Earth actually to combat this. Clarios and Pure Earth and UNICEF really have set out to protect every child's potential together and to end this lead exposure that we're seeing. Again, that's also affecting one third of children globally. That's just, you know, the irresponsible recycling of batteries or other ways that lead contaminants can get into our environment and into our climate. Bangladesh is one of the countries that this partnership is targeting, but is also one of those countries that's identified in that top list there of countries where the risk is the greatest. And I know of a story of a young boy who's 8 years old. His name was or is Anik, and he lives in Bangladesh and just loves soccer. And the place that he would go out and play soccer with his buddies, or football in his words, it all of a sudden turned into a sort of an unofficial battery recycling plant. Mm-hmm. And the air quality in the space, the bleed into the ground and whatnot was really having a tough impact on the community. And his mom was acknowledging, and he was saying, you know, it was just so strange. All of a sudden I was having a harder time with my schoolwork and I was losing like just memories here and there and having headaches. And unfortunately behind that story are these other sort of layers, in that, the reason that that little plot of land was available to become this unofficially battery recycling plant is because that the farmland there, was no longer usable due to the climate shocks and whatnot. And so I think to me, that was one of the other big takeaways in reading this report and just thinking about the work around the world is just the layers and the interconnectedness on this. Now, I would say one of the cool things about this, though, is that we know that there are solutions. I think that's part of the reason this partnership came together is because you're bringing together three groups that have the tools and the resources collectively to be able to end this. And so they are doing a lot of site remediation, awareness building work, which I think is massively important, not just on this topic, but on any topic related to the climate impact on children, is just helping kids understand how do we avoid these sorts of things in the first place, so we don't end up fixing it on the back end.
Yeah, what guidance does the report offer to policymakers?
Yeah, I mean, I think the other piece that's special to UNICEF's mandate is that we believe so strongly that children should have a seat at the table. They, again, are the ones who are carrying this on their shoulders today, but also into the future. And so they should certainly have access and a voice at the table as governments, as communities are tackling this. I know it sometimes sounds so lofty to say that kids should have a seat at the table with government. We really, really mean that. But I would say that every level, we know that, you know, even in our own house, whether we're choosing water, bottles of water, or the ways that we can make our own homes more sustainable, every single smaller action also will snowball up into greater actions for our planet too.
What are you hoping comes out of this risk index?
I think there's a few things. One, I would say a focus on the fact that it's time. I think the report is very serious. It paints the picture of the devastating impact of these climate risks on children today, not just the future, but literally today. So I hope that it serves as a wake-up call to our world. But what I really appreciate about the report is that it focuses in the data. It's not just broad strokes and the dark clouds, but it helps us say, okay, if we follow these numbers and we follow these maps and we can look at where can we reach the hardest to reach, then all boats can rise. And I would say that's a principle that guides our work always, but it is especially effective. It's effective for, you know, the philanthropy or the government dollars are going into climate action. When you target the hardest to reach, the rest can follow more easily. It's a more effective and efficient way of doing the work. But I also hope that it empowers young people. I hope that young people can see this as their opportunity to say, well, this is through my lens and with my voice, and that I too can take this information and do the little things or big things in my own sphere of influence to make a difference. And so there are some resources. UNICEF has a global platform for youth called Voices of Youth. So it's at voicesofyouth.org, and young kids and students in Wisconsin can connect with their peers around the planet to share different ideas about how they are elevating this concern.
And we can throw that link up on our website at wpr.org/mornings. And yeah, I'm wondering what response you've received so far since the report was published.
You know, I think there's been a ton of news on it. And I think there's been really great coverage in that regard. But I think there's been an appreciation for having a tool that can, again, focus our efforts. There have been, as we know, there's no shortage of reports or other content out there around the urgency behind this climate crisis. But I think what this offers is a real acknowledgement that the climate crisis is a child rights crisis. And for those who are focused on making our world a better place for kids, it offers a tool to help guide our actions together.
Well, thank you, Beth, for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Beth McCausland is the managing director of the Midwest region for UNICEF USA. Up next is news and a story of our Wisconsin life. Then, should we be paying people to get vaccinated? Let's talk about it. I'm Molly Stentz. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about losing a loved one during wartime.
For those who have fought and died in the U.S. Armed Forces, they leave with their families the weight of their sacrifice. Holly Higgins of Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, lost her son Daniel Johnson while he served in the Air Force in Afghanistan. Higgins talks about dealing with her loss with her other son, Eric Johnson, a specialist in the U.S. Army National Guard. They shared their experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
My name is Eric Johnson. I am 30 years old. I am in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. I am here with my mother, Holly Higgins.
Holly Higgins. I'm 64 years old here in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, with my son, Eric. What triggered you to want to go into the service to begin with?
One of my older brothers, out of four, Dan, was in the Air Force, and he had been for 2, maybe 3 years. He joined when I was still in high school, and I remember seeing a change in him in the way that he treated me as an older brother. I could tell that the military definitely impacted the way that he treated others, and I kind of wanted that for myself. In the transition of me making the decision to actually join, we found out that Dan was killed overseas. It wasn't an easy decision, but I think through his sacrifice, he still convinced me that what he stood for in regards to freedom and wanting to help others in the world, that it was worth it.
You know, it took me back. Hearing you talking about it makes me think back to when he first told me he was going to go into the Air Force and how I cried for many weeks. I was more afraid of him being hurt emotionally by war and combat. I didn't let myself even think that he could be physically or that he would die. And I remember him saying to me, you know, Mom, I'm going over there to save lives, not to take them. I don't even know how to put it, but I think knowing how important everything had become to you with what you were doing as an adult in your life, I was impressed with your courage, with your ability to choose to do what was right for you. And it was impressive. I'll always be afraid for you and your other brothers. You know, I mean, before Dan's death, I didn't think anything would ever happen to you guys. I just didn't think it could be possible. It wasn't going to happen to us, you know. Now I know that it can, and so there'll always be that. But I don't let that affect what I say to you or my trust and belief and hopes and pride in the choices that you make. I think you probably know about the mug he gave me and what that's come to represent for me with the poppies on it.
Yeah.
It's brought my spirit the ability to accept that this was Dan's destiny. That he found that mug in Scotland when he was 16 and brought it home for me. And at that point, no military discussion had ever been brought up. at the time, I didn't even notice that they were poppies. And he didn't know any, I don't think he knew what that would even mean. And it wasn't until 7 years after he was killed that I realized those were poppies on that month. And knowing that poppies represent the death on the battlefield has brought me just a peace in my soul. I mean, I'll never not be brokenhearted and wounded over Dan's death. I'll never not miss him, and I'll never feel like it was okay that it happened. But I know in my spirit that somehow it was his destiny. It was his path.
That was Holly Higgins and Eric Johnson of Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. They shared their experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Kate Archer-Kent. 55% of Wisconsinites have now received at least one shot of their COVID vaccine. That's the latest data from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Yet it's nowhere near the rate experts say is needed to achieve herd immunity and stop the spread. To try to bridge that gap, the state is now offering a $100 gift card if you get at least one dose of COVID vaccine by Labor Day. That's Monday. Have you taken them up on this offer? What's holding you back? Let us know. We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us, ideas@WPR.org. Here to tell us how this works is Karen Timberlake. She's the Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Welcome, Secretary Timberlake.
Thank you, and good morning.
Good morning to you. So why should we pay people to get vaccinated?
Well, let's think about what our overall goal here is. Our overall goal is to make sure that everyone across Wisconsin who is eligible to get vaccinated against the COVID-19 virus takes us up on that opportunity and gets vaccinated. We know that these vaccines are safe. They are highly effective. They are preventing lots of illness, lots of hospitalizations. They are preventing deaths. And what we are seeing is people who are not vaccinated at this point are the people who are getting really sick with COVID-19. They are ending up in our hospitals, and they are the people who are dying, unfortunately, still from this disease. So we have been at this since last December, right? That's when the vaccines first became available. And in order to connect everyone who's eligible with vaccine, we've deployed a lot of different strategies. So we have a lot of educational materials that are out there. We have a wonderful campaign involving doctors and nurses and other care providers from across our state sharing their confidence in the vaccine. We have created many, many, many points of access to get vaccinated. So doctor's offices and clinics and hospitals and pharmacies and employer-based clinics and public health-based clinics. What we now need to create for people who, as you noted at the top, are still not sure or they're still kind of hanging out there on the sidelines, we need to create a fresh wave of awareness of the need to get vaccinated. And frankly, we need to create a little sense of urgency. We've been at this for a long time. We all may have grown a little bit weary of thinking about COVID, talking about COVID, talking about the vaccine. So by introducing something new, like an incentive program, we create that sort of fresh burst of attention, that fresh burst of a need to pay attention to the fact that really everyone 12 years old and up is eligible to get vaccinated and needs to do that as a key strategy to helping us all get out of this pandemic.
So how many people do you expect to take advantage of this program?
Yep. So we modeled our program after a very similar program that was launched in the state of Minnesota. You know, we are comparable states in population and other characteristics. I'm sure people would have many opinions about lots of the differences between Wisconsin and Minnesota. That's not our topic.
They're ahead of us, though. in vaccination rates.
Correct, correct. Yep, yep. And so one of the things that we noted is that they had good success with this $100 incentive. And so that's our benchmark. And what we're seeing just in the 10 days or so since the incentive was launched, we are seeing a nice steady increase in people getting that first shot. And so I think it's really important for people to hear us that it's not too late. We have until September 6th for people to get that first shot. And to following getting your first shot, go to the website, which is 100.wisconsin.gov, or give us a call at 844-684-1064 to register your eligibility to get that $100 U.S. Bank rewards card. So there's still time. There's still a good reason to do this. You'll protect yourself. You'll protect your friends and family and your community, and you'll be a key part of getting us out of the COVID-19 pandemic.
And why $100?
$100, it seems to be enough to be motivating to people while still allowing us to be good stewards of the American Rescue Plan Act dollars, the federal funds that are funding this program. So we wanted to make the incentive available to absolutely as many people as would take us up on it. And we are very fortunate to have these American Rescue Plan Act dollars, but they are not unlimited. And so we wanted to pick a number that was motivating while still being good stewards of those resources.
We're speaking with Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, Karen Timberlake, and we're taking your calls this hour about the state's new vaccination incentive program. We're at 1-800-642-1234. And let's go to the phones now. We have Jim from Juneau joining us now. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, I do not agree with this $100 prize for doing something for yourself. One, it does very little to help teach the people why they should, one, do, you know, research to figure out if this is something right for them. I feel that this is Darwinism at its core. If you are smart, willing, or smart enough to openly research the information that's out there and not just follow along because some fear mongers telling you that this is a government conspiracy, then, you know, unfortunately, it is a way for these people to learn a very valuable lesson. And yes, I know that this is means that a possible, you know, death for certain people. My daughter still will not take the shot. So I am very upset with this, and I would do anything just about to help her come around to see the statistics, the true statistics, and the true nature of this disease.
Oh, but, Jim, I'm sorry about your daughter. I want to hear the secretary's what she has to say about your thoughts. Secretary Timberlake.
Yep, absolutely. So, Jim, thank you for making those points. And I think he really puts his finger on what so many families are dealing with across our state right now, which is the information has been out there, right? We've had hundreds of millions of doses of the Pfizer vaccine, the Moderna vaccine, and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine given across our country with amazing safety, really very, very, very minimal side effects and terrific effectiveness against serious illness, hospitalization, and death. And there are those of us who are paying attention to that data, who are deep in it, who understand it, and who say, how could we possibly need to do anything else to help move people forward? And I appreciate also his point that there will be people for whom a $100 incentive card or a reward card may not do it. That may be the case. our goal is to make sure that we continue to keep multiple lanes of information open for people, multiple points of access. You can go to vaccines.gov to find all the places across our state that are offering vaccine, including which vaccine they're offering. And we know that there will be people for whom the possibility of that $100 U.S. Bank rewards card is enough to motivate them.
Sure.
The other thing I want to address real quick in his comments is the need for all of us, sort of the question of what else can we do, right? Those of us who are frustrated and are seeing people who have all the information and still won't move ahead, and when that's in our own families, that can be very, very frustrating and very painful.
Yes.
What I want to encourage folks to do is to keep having those conversations, to keep connecting people to reliable sources of information, encourage people to talk with their own medical providers. We never know who the messenger is who's going to finally break through and cause a change of heart, and we all have to keep trying.
Well, Secretary Timberlake, hold that thought for a moment. We're going to check the weather and be back in just a moment. We're talking about Wisconsin's new COVID vaccine reward program. I'm Molly Stentz. This is The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. We're talking about COVID vaccination rates across the state and what it might take to get enough people vaccinated to curb the spread of the virus. If you're not yet vaccinated, will this gift card offer change your mind? We're talking with Wisconsin Department of Health Services Secretary Designee Karen Timberlake. And Secretary Timberlake, we have got full lines. There are so many people with questions for you that have comments and questions and concerns, and I want to take as many of them as we can this morning with the time that we have left. I want to go next to Jesse in Rhinelander. Good morning, Jesse.
Hi, good morning.
What's on your mind?
Well, you know, the only reason what's holding me also back is for me getting the shot. 'Cause I've been wanting to get the shot. I'm like that person that's halfway with trying to do it and not do it. It's just the fact that, you know, that I know that some people do get sick when they get the shot, and that's what I'm afraid of, just getting sick for like 2 or 3 days trying to overcome that shot. So, but we don't get no time off from work. So if somebody was to force all these companies to say, you know what, if the technicians or your employees get the shot, can you guys give them some days off from work by getting that shot? I think that would probably help.
Such a good point, Jesse. Thank you. Secretary Timberlake.
Yeah, it's an excellent point, and thank you for raising it, Jesse. I want to just underscore it real quickly to say every employer listening out there, what Jesse says is absolutely true. While most people experience very mild side effects from the COVID-19 vaccine, it certainly can be the case that people don't feel well enough to come to work for a day or two, and they can't be at risk of losing their jobs. We're asking them to get vaccinated in order to protect all of us, and all of our employers have a role to play in making it possible for people to do that. And I will also add, a key part of helping us get out of this pandemic is making sure that if people do come down with COVID-like symptoms, they have an opportunity to not come to work so that they can go get themselves tested, make sure they don't have COVID-19, and are safe to come back to work. It's a key point, and we certainly do underscore that with all of the employers that we work with.
Right. And you could potentially be out for a longer period of time if you're dealing with symptoms and needing to quarantine.
That's exactly right. And certainly it's also worth noting that one of the difficult things about the COVID-19 virus is that it acts very differently for very different people, and there are people who get extremely sick and are certainly out of many more days of work than they would be with just a few, you know, sore arm and a few flu-like symptoms for a day or two. So the safer choice is absolutely to get vaccinated. And we do need our employers to be working with all of their employees to make sure that that's possible.
Well, let's go back to the phones. We have Margie next. Margie joining us from Milwaukee. Good morning, Margie.
Hi. I just wanted to say I think the $100 incentive is reaching an important group that are frazzled, and it's hard for them to maybe work. Maybe they're working 2 or 3 jobs. And as the last caller said, you know, it can help cover sick time that's not covered. You have to do different things to reach different markets. And you're not going to probably reach the ones that are diehard against the vaccine, but the ones that are overbooked and overstressed, it's possible. Plus, it's the young adults that often think that, oh, I'm not going to worry because I'm strong enough, I'm young enough, I'll get through it. Just like with Obamacare, they were the last to sign up for it. And $100 makes a difference to them. So if it helps all of us, I think it's a good cause.
Thank you, Margie. Secretary Timberlake, what do you think?
Margie sounds like she was in some of our design meetings. Thank you, Margie. Those are all the right points to emphasize. An additional thing I'll note that I don't think we've had a chance to touch on yet is it's important to remember that not everyone can get vaccinated yet. Right. So people, our kids under the age of 12, there still is no vaccine that is approved for them. We do expect that very soon, but very soon is not right now. And so we all have a role to play in making sure that not only we keep ourselves safe, but we keep our kids safe, we help our schools open safely and stay open, and we can do that by getting vaccinated and by wearing masks in public places.
And to Margie's point, I noticed that, you know, while you mentioned vaccines are available for teenagers, the vaccination rates are lower than the rest of the age cohorts. Young people are not getting vaccinated as much. What do you think that is?
Yep,
that's about?
Yep, for sure. I think it's absolutely the case that, you know, the early data that we saw as COVID was really spreading was that it was really affecting our older adults most seriously, 65 and older, and that continues to be true. And so people 65 and older were the first people to get vaccinated. And I what we also know is that, you know, getting vaccinated is a habit that comes with regular access to medical care. It comes, you know, for our older adults maybe with having some memory of when we had polio and it was critical for everyone to get vaccinated against polio in this country. And for, you know, your average 18, 19, 23-year-old, that's a distant memory. They may not even appreciate the fact that they didn't have chicken pox because they got vaccinated against it. They may not have a usual source of care. So Margie's right that we need to do something to sort of get their attention, and that's what a incentive like this can do.
Well, Secretary, we're up against the end of the hour, but I wonder what vaccination rate are you hoping we can achieve in the state of Wisconsin?
We are still working to get as close to that 80% vaccination rate as we can. We know that we need to get to a place where we have as much community immunity as is possible. I would encourage everyone to go to vaccines.gov to find a place to get their vaccine. Come to our DHS website to get some more good facts and data about the vaccine. Call 211 if you have questions or you need help arranging transportation to get to your vaccine appointment. And go to 100.wisconsin.gov to register for that vaccine incentive if you get your first shot by Monday.
Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you.
Karen Timberlake, Secretary Designee of Wisconsin Department of Health Services. I'm Molly Stentz, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.